So we are continuing in the epistles, or the letters in the New Testament. We've looked at the letter to Rome, and that was to a specific church or a specific group of churches. We looked at the book of Galatians, which was to a larger area of churches, but still a specific area. But because it was to a group of churches, it was kind of a pseudo-general epistle. So we looked at the book of Ephesians, and that was one of the prison epistles, where Paul wrote that from prison while he was in prison in Rome. We looked at the book of 1 Timothy, and that represented one of the pastoral epistles, which were letters that were written to ministers dealing with specific topics of how to lead a church and how to provide organization for the church. And so to finish this sampling of letters from the New Testament, today we're going to be looking at a general epistle. We're actually going to finish up the whole thing with two general epistles. That'll be James and the book of 1 Peter. These are letters that were not written to a specific person. Like 1 Timothy was written to a specific person. It wasn't general epistles or not. They're called general because they're not written to a specific church or a specific area of churches like Rome or Ephesians was written to the church in Ephesus or possibly the churches there, the house churches that were meeting, or even Galatians. It was written to a larger area, but still very specific topics that were being covered in the book of Galatians. It is a general epistle, and these are letters that were just simply written to Christians, for Christians to read on Christian living, letters that they could that would cover general topics on how to live more like Christ. And so we're going to be looking at 1 Peter and then and James we're going to start with today. Kind of interesting with the letters. I know a lot of you guys would know this, but just in case, you know, a little bit of, Bible trivia, a little surface level, that some of the books that we've studied, like Romans, Ephesians, Galatians, those books were written, or they're titled after who the recipient churches were going to be. 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, Titus, those were the pastoral epistles. They were titled according to who the individual recipient was. The general epistles are backwards. James, 1st, 2nd Peter, 1st, 2nd, 3rd John, Jude, they're all written, or they're all titled by the author. Does that make sense? So it kind of switches around. So sometimes, you know, when we're reading 1st Timothy, it wasn't written by Timothy, it was written to Timothy. But when you're reading James, it wasn't written to James, it was written by James. So it's kind of interesting to look at that and kind of see the differences between the two. So James is the author, and there are a number of Jameses that could be looked at as authors of the book of James. Two that are in the list that are the most likely candidates would be James the disciple, which is John's brother, the sons of Zebedee, or James the brother of Jesus. And James the brother of Jesus is the best fit. We go into a whole lot there, but not as much need. He is traditionally viewed as the author, and that understanding has not been contested strong enough to really veer from that understanding. James the disciple, the brothers, the sons of Zebedee, John and James, that James was martyred too early to be the author. And with the other possible Jameses that are out there, they're not as plausible as James, the brother of Jesus. So if this is James, the brother of Jesus that writes this, then what do we know about him? We actually know quite a bit about his history. We know that at one point in time, if he was Jesus' brother or half-brother, if you want to call it that, that he didn't believe. We see that in John chapter 7, verse 5 there, that even his own brothers did not believe in him. But that changed. James came to believe in Jesus. We know this because the very end of his, well, we know this through the life that some of the pieces I want to share with you here, but you skip and jump forward to the very end of his life. James was a martyr for the faith. James, according to tradition, he was thrown from the highest point of the temple and did not die on impact, and so then they stoned him to death. And so that was a well-known tradition of how James was martyred. He was martyred as a result of his faith in Jesus and his dedication to sharing the gospel message of his half-brother. So something changed there. We see a number of things. First of all, we see that Jesus appeared to James specifically, separate from, listed separate from the disciples. So we know it's not James the disciple that Paul's talking about in 1 Corinthians. He talks about the death and burial and resurrection of Jesus. He said that he was buried, talking about Jesus. He was raised on the third day according to the scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, which that's Peter, and to the 12. After that, he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers and sisters at the same time, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James, so he singles him out. And James became a prominent figure in the church. So for Paul to include this in his letter to the Corinthians, they would have known, oh, that James, the James in Jerusalem, the James that's a prominent leader there in one of the first churches. So he appeared to James, then to the apostles, and last of all, he appeared to me, Paul, talking about himself, as one abnormally born. James was a prominent leader in the Jerusalem church. At the beginning of Paul's ministry, right after his conversion, we're told that he went to Damascus for 3 years. And then Paul writes in Galatians, he says, "Then after 3 years, I went up to Jerusalem to get acquainted with Cephas," which that's Peter, "and stay with him 15 days. I saw none of the other apostles, only James, the Lord's brother." So we get a very clear understanding that the James that was in Jerusalem was, in fact, Jesus' brother. And near the end of Paul's ministry, when he was arrested in Jerusalem, he stopped by. We talked about this when we were talking about Ephesians and in Timothy. He swung by the Ephesus to see the Ephesian elders, the elders of the church there, and then he went to Jerusalem where he was going to be arrested. It says, when we arrived, this is Luke writing Acts, so this is part of the "we" statements. Luke was with him at this point. "When we arrived at Jerusalem, the brothers and sisters received us warmly. The next day, Paul and the rest of us went to see James, and all the elders were present." So he's kind of singled out as one of the leaders there. Paul greeted them and reported in detail what God had done among the Gentiles through his ministry. So the author of this letter, he knew Jesus well on multiple levels. He grew up with him, so he knew him as a half-brother, but he also knew him as his Savior, as the Messiah, and as the Christ. He was a very active leader in the church in Jerusalem, and that church became a central location or a hub for the early church. he knew the life of a doubter as well as the life of a faithful follower of Jesus. He watched as God opened the gospel message into the whole world. You can see this in the book of Acts as Peter's kind of working with James in the Jerusalem church as he starts to reach out to the Gentiles, and then Paul comes along and really reaches out into the Gentile world, and James was a part of all that, watching as the gospel spread to the whole world. As a key leader in one of the key churches, James is mentioned by name as people sought out his support, his advice, because the church was expanding. And so we see that James has a great deal of wisdom. And this is confirmed, and it's in connection with his letter that we're going to be studying here. A letter that is kind of like a New Testament Proverbs. In the Old Testament, you've got the book of Proverbs, and that's wisdom from the wisest man that ever lived, Solomon. In the New Testament, you have James. And it's really a book of wisdom on several different topics. And as we study through this, we're going to be studying the topics. So it's not going to be the expository style where it's verse by verse. We'll do verse by verse, but in topic sections. But we're going to be looking at different topics about wisdom. So wisdom in trials, wisdom in action, wisdom in choices, wisdom of your tongue, wisdom of how we view others, and wisdom in knowing who to turn to for more wisdom. And that's prayer. So we're starting today with trials. Let's talk about wisdom in trials. A trial is anything that tests me. Let me just get a base definition of what a trial is. A trial is anything that tests me. This is the first topic that James talks about in his letter, and this is how he opens this letter. It's kind of, ironic, humorous as you read it. He just starts off, "James, a servant of God and of the Lord Jesus Christ, to the 12 tribes scattered among the nations." It's just to Christians. It's to any Christian that would read this. "Greetings. Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, when you face trials of many kinds. That's the opening line to his letter after his greeting. It's consider it pure joy when you're suffering, when you're going through trials. I mean, this was a current topic for them. We hear about stories of J. Henry and his life being risked for the gospel, and Walton Joby on their trip being in a big car chase with guns and, you know, all sorts of excitement there. We hear about that. That happens today. It was happening there, and for James to mention this, they would have connected to this instantly. The trials that they were going through. And we go through trials. We have different things, especially in the way America has been making some changes and different things that, you know, it's interesting. Chris is back there. The story that Chris shared, some of the reporting that I've seen on it was just mentioning that he had a problem with organized religion. That is not accurate. It was specifically, as Chris said, it was specifically towards Christians, not just organized religion. But that's how they're going to report it. If it were any other group, they'd be reporting it specifically. They'd say, well, this is a hate crime against this race, or it was a hate crime against this religion, but it's Christianity. So instead of saying Christianity, they say organized religion. And so things are changing, and we're going to be seeing things like that coming up. People like Salonique, who go face to face with witchcraft in the form of voodoo and the witch doctors down there. So to God's church scattered throughout the nations, experiencing hardship, tests, and trials, this is the first topic that James turns to. And in fact, this is a main topic that 1 Peter is about, which we'll be studying the second half of November. So James says, consider it pure joy when you go through rough times. I don't know about you, but pure joy is not the first go-to phrase that I think about when I'm going through trials, when I'm going through testing, when I'm going through persecution, tough times, rough times, toxic relationships, condescending people, hurtful words, threats, false accusations, unstable situations, tumultuous circumstances, or hazardous or dangerous environments. I've had my share of those, and I assure you, pure joy is not the first two words that come to my mind when I recollect, when I remember, when I relive those moments, those times, those situations, those circumstances in my mind, much less when I'm actually in those situations to be able to consider it pure joy. James says we should consider it pure joy. This is a very strong word. It means all joy, complete joy, utter joy when trials come our way. Not just to put a happy face on. He's not saying put a mask on and disguise the turmoil we're going through inside. It's not just an optimistic comment from someone like me who's a diehard optimist, saying, well, just look at the light side. Just look at, there's a bright side. There's a silver lining here. It's not where James was. In fact, it doesn't fit his personality. As you read the letter, as we study the letter, you're going to realize James was not an optimist. James was a realist. Here's what it is. Here's what you got. The idea is that we should actually rejoice when trials come our way. Let's take that personally and write that down. I should rejoice when trials come my way. Does this mean that we should be a church of masochists? That we should find pleasure in being abused? That we should find some twisted enjoyment in feeling pain? And that was something that was celebrated at one time. To be a martyr for the faith was something that was celebrated. And that's, it's not that we're to enjoy the pain or to enjoy the trial or enjoy the hardship or enjoy the persecution or the abuse. I should rejoice when trials come my way, not because the pain is enjoyable. Give you a second on that. Not because the pain is enjoyable, but because of the victory that can be experienced when the trial is over. That was nice and quiet, Monta. That was an amen moment, wasn't it? Should I say that again? Should I say that? Yeah. We should rejoice, or I should rejoice, when trials come my way, not because the pain is enjoyable, but because the victory that can be experienced when the trial is over. Amen. The joy is not in the current pain. The joy is in the anticipation. Ultimately, our suffering will end with the second coming of Christ. We all know that. And so that is a joy to look forward to. A joy that will end all of the trials. But we gain a lot during our time here on earth as we go through trials as well. And there's a joy found in the end result of each trial we go through. Trials come in many different forms, actually two general different forms. So let's write that down. Trials come in two forms. The first form is testing, and that's an external, that's external difficulties test the perseverance of my faith. External difficulties test the perseverance of my faith. What gets tricky in Scripture is that the same word for testing is the same word for trial. Can also be used as the same word for tempt. And so you really have to work with context when you're looking at those different words. And so James does a good job here of describing these two forms of this one word. So you have testing, and then later we're going to be talking about tempting. So testing is external difficulties. He says in verse 3, he says, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance, let perseverance finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. So perseverance, steadfastness, fortitude, constancy, persistent determination, consistency, a heroic endurance. Hebrews chapter 10, verse 39 says, but we do not belong to those who shrink back and are destroyed. That's not what we belong to, church. That's not who we are as Christians. We don't belong to those who shrink back and are destroyed, but those who have what? Faith. Those who have faith and are saved. See, the testing of my faith produces perseverance. That's a perseverance of my faith. How strong is my faith? How much can it take? How much can it stand up against? Because a faith that can't be tested can't be... Oh, you guys have heard me say that before. A faith that can't be tested can't be trusted. Maybe I should have had that in your bulletins. A faith that can't be tested can't be trusted. And external difficulties will test the perseverance of my faith. I can be tested by natural circumstances. We live in a physically fallen world. There is disease, there is sickness, there are health problems. Those will put your faith to the test. There's natural disaster, tornadoes, tsunamis, hurricanes, earthquakes, depending on what region you live in. Those will test your faith, the perseverance of your faith and your trust in God as those things happen. Natural circumstances by human influence. You can have something as simple as an accident, leaving a candle burning as you leave the house and come back to see fire trucks and a house fire. Falling down a flight of stairs and having a broken arm. Working on dinner in the kitchen and cutting yourself with a knife and needing to go and get stitches. Simple things, but as we lean on God in every situation, all of those little trials, all those things that we go through, these external difficulties can help to see our faith in God persevere. Change imposed on us by others' choices. Loss of a job. The stock market dropping. I know a number of you years ago suffered from that as you'd put a lot of your retirement and you watched it get cut in half years ago. You had nothing to do with that. Where could you turn to? Who could you lean on for that? That money's gone. But you put your faith in God, and so you leaned on him. And it was a test of your faith, your perseverance. A drunk driver, a rogue shooter on a college campus, change imposed on us by others' choices or even our own decisions can lead to natural circumstances that would test our perseverance of our faith. I can be tested by supernatural influences as well. God can let me be tested. I think many of us are familiar with the story of Job, where Satan enters God's presence and God says, "Hey, have you met my servant Job? He's pretty awesome." And he says, "Well, he'll denounce your name, you know, if troubles come, if things get rough for him." And God's like, "Well, go for it. You can do this and this and this, but you can't do this." And so God let him be tested by Satan, a supernatural influence. God can let things happen to us in our life. Some things I think are natural. Something, you know, I've shared this with you guys before. I'm not the type of person that believes everything happens for a reason. Some people believe that and they subscribe to that. I believe some things just happen. We live in a fallen world. There's cancer. You know, sharing with about Sherry's mom. That's awful. And we're going to be praying for her. But that's the world we live in. That doesn't mean that God willed that to happen. It just happened because that's the world we have. There are times, though, where God lets things happen, like in the story of Job. And sometimes we don't know when those different things are occurring. Sometimes until hindsight in 2020, we realize, oh, wow, God had a hand in that. And then other things, we look back and we say, that just doesn't make sense that God would let that happen. Well, maybe it just happened. And then there are other times, we can write this down, when God himself will put me to the test. When God himself, the story of Abraham and Isaac comes to mind, when Abraham finally has a son, the promised son that is going to produce offspring, that numbers as many of this, as the sky has stars and as much as the sand has, or the seashore has little grains of sand. And this first son, Isaac, and God says, okay, now that you have him, I want you to go and kill him. Climb up, and Abraham did. We'll be talking a little more about that next week, that story. But sometimes God himself will put me to the test. The testing of my faith and perseverance is necessary for my growth as a Christian. It is necessary. It provides the stairs we walk up. It provides the traction that moves us forward. It is necessary for my growth as a Christian. I'll go back up and reread the end of that passage we just read. Let perseverance finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking anything. And this is why we should consider it pure joy when we face trials of many kinds, as James says. That these external difficulties, that they will test the perseverance of our faith. And ultimately, that leads to a better us. That leads to an us that is more like Christ. A me that's more like Christ. A you that's more like Christ. As your faith perseveres through these different situations, these external circumstances. Then in verse 12, James says, "Blessed is the one who perseveres under trial, because having stood the test, that person will receive the crown of life that the Lord has promised to those who love him." So the first form of trials is through testing, and that's an external difficulty that tests the perseverance of my faith. The second form of trials is temptation. And that is an internal, that's internal struggles that test the perseverance of my resolve. Are you really in this? How dedicated are you? James says in verse 13, he says, "When tempted, no one should say, 'God is tempting me.' For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. I'll pause there just for a second. No, this is off notes. In the book of Hebrews, the Hebrews writer says that God tests people. And I don't know if any of you guys have ever heard anyone look at the study of those. That's the same exact word to this one. So in Hebrews, he says God will test you. In James, he says God will not tempt you. And it's the same word, but you got to look at context. That's what I was talking about earlier. God will put us to the test, but God will not tempt us. And we're going to get to James's logic here. So when tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me, for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each person is tempted when they are dragged away by their, say this with me, own evil desire and enticed. Turn to your neighbor, say, your own evil desire. Turn to your other neighbor and say, my own evil desire. We got to own it. Let's write this down. I am responsible for my own temptations. Yeah, I think the next one, I don't think it moves to the next slide. Not God, not others, not even Satan, when you understand James's understanding of what temptation is, how he defines this. We have to own it. Back in the very first sin with Adam and Eve in the garden, when God confronted Adam, he says, you know, how did you know you're naked? And Adam's excuse, Adam's reason was, that woman that you gave me, that woman you put here, she did it. She gave me some fruit from the tree and I ate it. It's her fault. So God doesn't deal with that quite yet. But he turns to Eve and he's like, what about you? What is this? What is this you've done? And of course, Eve, that snake, that serpent, it was his fault. See, passing the buck is as old as sin itself. To find someone to blame. We don't like to own our own sin. We don't like to own our own evil desires. Really, Eve owned her own decision. It wasn't Satan that tempted her. Yes, he had a conversation with her. Yes, that conversation, in that conversation, his goal was to cause her to question God, to doubt God's words. But it was her own evil desire that enticed her and led her to sin. And Adam really owned his own decision. I believe the Eagles captured this thought pretty good. When they said, I found out a long time ago that what a woman can do to your soul. But she can't take you anyway. You don't already know how to go. So did Eve go to Adam with the fruit of knowledge of good and evil? Did she hand it to him? Did she tempt him? She put it in his hand, but it was his own desire that snared him. You can put a lot of things in my hand that I won't eat. Just because you put it in my hand and say, hey, eat this, it's good. You can put Brussels sprouts. You can put a bowl of Brussels sprouts in my hand. And you can say, this is great for you. It's healthy. They taste wonderful. And I guarantee you, I will not eat or take one bite of a bowl of Brussels sprouts in my hand. Why? It's not desirable to me. Therefore, it's not a temptation. So you can put whatever you want in people's hands. But it's their own evil desire that tempts them. You look at Adam and Eve. It wasn't Eve that tempted Adam. It wasn't the snake that tempted Eve. It was their own evil desire. If Adam had not desired to eat of the fruit, it wouldn't have mattered what she put in his hand. I'm sure it didn't hurt coming from a naked woman that was probably as perfect as they come. but it was still his own desire that tempted him. You can put a big bowl of Rocky Road ice cream in my hand, and you can tell me how dangerous it is to eat, how fattening, how many calories and how many carbs, and about that time, all I'm going to hear is blah, blah, blah as the spoon goes to my mouth. And you can keep talking. Why would I do that? Because it's desirable to me. My own evil desire. It drags me away and entices me. James uses a fishing reference here. To be carried off, dragged away, or drawn out. To be enticed or lured. How many fishermen, fisherwomen do we have in the group here today? Okay? That's what you do. You lure them in. You entice them. Let's write this down. My own. Everyone say, my own. Evil desire is that which draws me and snares me. It is both the bait and the trap. We are lured in and pierced by the barbed hook. How astonishing would it be if we watched a fish sit up on the shore, bait a hook with a worm, drop it into the water, and then jump in, swim up to that very hook, and take a bite, and wait for a fisherman to pull it in, to drag him off, to carry him away, to draw him out of the water. That'd be astonishing in such a negative way. But that is the picture that James is painting here for us. We are the fish. We bait our own hook, and then we bite it. It's our own evil desire. Then James switches illustrations in midstream. Yeah, see what I did there? Midstream. He switches to the illustration of conception and birth. Verse 15, he says, then after desire has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. Our own evil desire is now illustrated as it is personified as a mother. A mother that conceives, gives birth to sin, and then sin causes death. This is simply an illustration. It's not an allegory. There's a lot of people that try to force things on this. The simplicity of what James is saying is that sin is not something to be toyed with. It is deadly. The wage of sin is death. That's the deal. That's what we're dealing with here. Sin is not to be trivialized. It's not something to play with. It's not something to be toyed with. It is serious business. It leads to death. And that's the truth. So, are we to consider this pure joy? I mean, how can we count this kind of trial as pure joy? We shouldn't find temptation or being tempted or falling to temptation a joy at all. It's rebellion. We should feel bad for that. But once again, as it was with the external difficulties, it is with the internal struggles that it's not that moment that we are to enjoy, but rather what that moment can lead to when we don't take the bait, when we aren't snared and trapped, when we aren't carried off out of the water, when we do not let our evil desires, our own evil desires, conceive, then there is no birth to sin in that moment. And in that moment, we have proven the resolve of our desire to stay true to the gospel, to stay true to our God. And our character has grown more in likeness of Jesus, who was tempted in every way, just as we are, yet he did not sin. See, and that's where the joy is found. That's where rejoicing is found. When we see the perseverance of our resolve, when we see the victory of our dedication to not take a bite. And that's why when that moment approaches, the moment's not enjoyable, but as soon as it's there, consider it pure joy. I love the psychology of what James is hitting at here. When it hits, already think, I've beat this. I've conquered this. I'm going to succeed. I'm going to be victorious. You're already thinking that. I love that psychology. It's not when the trial comes and you're thinking, oh no, what is this? Or the storm, we better hunker down. James is saying, no, consider it pure joy. You need to think through it, think past it, and know, I'm going to conquer this with God's help. I'm going to be victorious. Whether it's external circumstances, my faith is going to persevere. Or if it's internal struggles, my resolve is going to persevere. And that's where the pure joy comes from. When I'm victorious, I get to witness that I'm growing to be more like Jesus, who did not sin when he was tempted. This is something that you can look forward to. But it's also something that you can experience right now. I want you to think of a temptation that you did not fall to this past week. Or maybe sometime last month. Maybe it was something big. And you stood up. You didn't fall to it. Celebrate that today. James says in chapter 5, he says, be patient then, brothers and sisters, until the Lord's coming. See how the farmer waits for the land to yield its crop, valuable crop? Patiently waiting for the autumn and spring rains. You too, be patient and stand firm, because the Lord's coming is near.